Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
Hello, hello. Happy Tuesday. It is me, Kristen Bry. Steve is still in Scotland. I did hear from him very quickly this morning. I said, how's the trip? He said, awesome. Visited St. Andrews a couple hours ago. Heading to a Neolithic site in a bit. Beautiful country. Been in about 8 pubs already. So good for you, Steve. But we will see him back in about a week. So looking forward to that. But have a big show planned today. We're going to have a conversation with an author who wrote a book called Misguided, where misinformation starts, how it spreads, and what to do about it. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. And then in next hour, we're going to be talking to Carmen Petrie from Sojourner Family Peace Center to talk about why the public safety building in Milwaukee affects a lot more people than just those who work and are detained in it. So really looking forward to our show today. But I wanted to start this first half hour hopefully with some listener participation, because I got an email yesterday, and you know, I get emails, I get DMs a fair amount sometimes of people who are liking what I had to say. Often it is people not liking what I had to say in any of the different forums where I am saying things. But it was a kind of a long email, but I wanted to read it because, one, it seemed very genuine. And two, I think it brings up an interesting conversation, especially in light of what we were talking about yesterday. And so I was kind of rehashing my experience of going to the protest in Milwaukee on Saturday and taking my mom, who had never gone to a protest before. And so I got this email, and so bear with me as I read through it, but I'm going to keep it anonymous and not say who sent it. So here we go. Kristen, I heard a small snippet of your show today. You were discussing the No Kings protests this weekend. Sounds like you may have attended one yourself. Not sure what those protests were about, as we don't have any kings governing us right now. The left just doesn't like the outcome of the November election and wants everyone to know it. It is quite interesting how quickly liberals take to the streets and protest and or riot. It seems quite organized. That is in contrast to conservatives, who rarely are marching in the streets, no matter how bad the Democrats are or how bad the left's agenda is. Joe Biden was a terrible president. He was disliked by most on the right, and his policies were very unpopular with the right. His open borders were dangerous and treasonous. His student debt vote buying scheme was unconstitutional, yet President Biden acted like an authoritarian, and he did what he wanted. Rarely did we see conservatives take to the streets to express their displeasure at President Biden, President Obama, etc. They tend to not act out emotionally, as Democrats tend to do. That would be why the left still brings up January 6th. That is the one of the few times that the right took to the street. I'm not condoning what a small percentage of the crowd did at the Capitol. The vast majority of those in D.C. that day were there to support President Trump and engage in peaceful protest. Even many of those who were left inside the Capitol via open doors did nothing violent. Again, the right just does not feel the need to run up into the streets at the drop of a hat and protest over made-up things such as claiming that Donald Trump is a king. As much as they dislike Democrat presidents and what they do to the country, they generally don't run into the streets and have a hissy fit. Sorry this got so long. I guess I'm just curious as to why liberals feel this need to always be in the streets protesting. We saw this during Trump's first term as well. Many Democrats refused to accept the outcome of the 2016 and were election deniers. Even Hillary falsely claimed that 2016 was stolen from her and Trump was not the legitimate president. Republicans can't stand Democrat presidents any more than Democrat can stand Republican presidents. But you don't see Republicans having this bizarre need to rush into the streets and let everyone know how unhappy they are. End of email. And I read this. There's things in here that I disagree with that I think are seen through a certain lens. But I'm reading it and I want to talk about it because I think there's a genuine question here. Like, I think this person is genuinely asking the difference. And I feel like I've been hearing this a fair amount. I think even when we talked to Bill McCosh on Friday, he brought up this point as far as where were the protests when Obama was deporting people, who's, you know, still the deporter in chief as far as how many people he ended up deporting. And so I want to hear from you, first of all, as far as, one, do you agree? Do you think the left protests more than the right? And if so, why? Because I think my gut instinct is yes, as far as left policies in general, not just Democrats protesting Republicans, but when we think of policies, issues, marginalized groups, and where they tend to fall on the political spectrum, it does seem like the left, when you try to think of examples, is out in the streets more than I consider the right. And so I would love to hear from you of what you think about this. I also asked, ChatGPT what it thought when it came to who protests more, liberals or conservatives. And I think you might be interested in the response it gave. But this, I'll give my take first as far as what I think the reason is. And I think it's the left tends to value collective action and social justice and systemic change. And I think that aligns itself more often with protest as a tool versus the right, which I think tends to think of and emphasize individualism and order and traditional institutions. And I think typically thinks disruptive protest feels less aligned with a conservative identity. And so, like, the left feels that protest is part of the democratic process, that is part of our country as far as our ability to do that and what the First Amendment stands for, versus the right seeing it as disruptive or radical unless they feel personally under threat. Which kind of goes with what Steve said last week, which I got some feedback on as far as his never have gone to a protest and what would get him to a protest. So what do you think? Do you agree that the left protests more than the right? And if so, why? 855-616-1620. Shoot me a text or give me a call and we will get to that after this. And I will let you know what ChatGPT said on the issue. So stay with us on Point Taken.
We can change.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry, and we are having a conversation based on an email I got yesterday, genuinely asking why liberals, the left, tend to take to the streets more often than conservatives. And, you know, I think there is, to a certain extent, we know that January 6th started as a protest. We know that there were, I remember back in 2020, the initial protest in Madison for the shutdowns, and I think they brought a gallows, and there were signs that said, I need a haircut. So, obviously, there's also the Tea Party, right? The Tea Party back when Obama's first term, there was a lot of protests then. So it's not totally one side versus the other that never partakes in protests. But when you put the big umbrella up of different types of protests, whether it's abortion or climate change or racism and Black Lives Matter, I would say there is more left-leaning protests that are organized than you tend to see on the right. And so I wanted to have a conversation about it as far as texts are coming in, I can see that I think a lot of people agree with this. But I'm more interested in thinking of why is that? Because if you remember last week, I forgot which day it was, but I asked Steve, because we were talking about the coming protests on Saturday, and I asked Steve, have you ever been to a protest? And he said, no. And I asked him what would get him to protest. And his answer was something along the lines of, if someone personally in his life was being affected. And it was interesting because I got some feedback through DMs or emails of some people who were disappointed with his answer. But his answer didn't surprise me at all, because I think that is typically him as a conservative. I think it kind of falls into this conversation that we're having, is it is more of a tool for people who are looking for systematic change, or a tool for marginalized groups who don't necessarily have power. power or access to power to try to gain power historically. And so I'm going to go through some of the texts as well. But if you would like to call, if you have a thought on why this is, 855-616-1620. But I definitely want to hear from you because I there's a lot of texts coming in. And so I think this is an interesting conversation. And I'm not going to read the ones that are insulting or fairly shallow. If they're devastatingly clever, maybe I will read them. But I'm really interested for people who are curious and trying to seek the answer to this and actually giving thoughtful responses versus just paid protesters and George Soros, et cetera, et cetera. But I did ask ChatGPT to try to summarize this. Now, we all know that ChatGPT sometimes just makes things up, but I was actually pretty impressed with the answer. So I had a very plain, neutral question, and I just put in, who protests more in the United States, liberals or conservatives? And this is what I got back. In the United States, both liberals and conservatives protest, but liberals tend to organize and participate in public protest more frequently and at larger scale overall, especially in recent years. Here's a breakdown. So they put liberals, progressives, and the left under one bucket and have some different bullet points. So more frequent protests, especially around issues like racial justice, climate change, women's rights, gun control, immigration. They tend to use protests as a core tactic in activism, like marches, sit-ins, street demonstrations, and are often centered in urban areas with a stronger protest culture and infrastructure. Now, conservatives. Fewer protests overall, but still significant, especially when, one, they feel power is being taken away, for example, in response to COVID mandates, gun right issues, or elections, or they mobilize around identity, so religious freedom, patriotism, anti-woke themes. Notable examples, Tea Party rallies, protests against COVID-19 lockdowns and vaccine mandates, and the January 6th Capitol, insert your word that you would like to call it, insurrection, protest, gathering. So that they quote some data, and in a 2021 Pew Research survey found that Democrats were more likely than Republicans to say they had attended a protest or a demonstration in the past year. And academic studies show liberal causes dominate protest turnout in volume, though conservatives are catching up in some regions and on certain issues. So in summary, liberals protest more often and in greater numbers, especially around systemic or national issues. Conservatives protest less frequently, but often with intense emotional or identity-driven motives when they do. So, what do you think? Did ChatGPT summarize it well? I think that was a pretty good. And I think it's often someone. I think there was a text over here that said, you know, on the conservative side, there's more of an effort to make government smaller instead of make government better. And I think that's kind of right, too, as far as the holding power to account nature of what a protest is and trying to make our politicians better versus the core tenet of we just want to be able to drown government in a bathtub. All right. I think we have a couple calls. We're going to take a break quickly. I'm going to go through some of these texts and read some of the ones that I think are make the smartest points. And we'll be back on Point Taken after this. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry, and we are having a conversation around who protests more, the left or the right, and why. And so we have a caller, Brian from Watertown. Why do you think the left or the right protests more? What's your theory?
Well, again, as I told the screener, I'm not really sure who does more than the other, but I'm saying probably because they have more to actually protest. Otherwise, they wouldn't be protesting. But the other big thing I was commenting to him about was the deportations. And, you know, the only ones that gave Obama any credit for those, for the deporting that was going on were other Democrats. You know, the Republicans won't acknowledge the sheer numbers that he did deport. And even Biden, up until April, had deported more than Trump did. But those were being done legally, you know, and the correct way. And the deportation is when you get sent back to the country of origin, not to some foreign country where you're in a prison. You know, you have absolutely no freedoms. And again, it was being done legally. You had a chance to speak up for yourself, and you were actually charged with something, and you knew what you were being charged with. It isn't happening now, and somebody has to speak up for these people.
Absolutely. Brian, let me ask you, have you been to a protest?
No, I haven't.
No,
I just don't have time.
You don't have time?
I don't have time.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call, Brian. Like, I love your input. All right. So there's a lot of text on this. So I think throughout the show, because after the bottom of the hour news, we do have a guest, but I'm going to continue to sift through the text, and maybe we'll continue this conversation throughout today's show. But one that I did like, take their guns, them being the right, and I bet conservatives will protest in the streets. Different people fight for different things. And then another text said, look at the great protest movements of the recent past. Civil rights, the Vietnam War, abortion rights. Protests are not are an important form of democracy, allowing the masses to voice their opinion. This is not right or left. Another person said the right is more affluent. I don't know if that's true anymore, but the left may not have to work during the day. My roommate works as a bartender and went, left tends to be younger and likely more emotionally reactionary. The right doesn't like being told what to do and will jump at the opportunity to read the riot act, the perceived of the government is taking away their rights. Don't tread on me vibes. But yeah, I think this is very interesting as far as what kind of core characteristics or personality traits you have as a person that kind of leads you to be on one side or the other of the political spectrum, and your propensity to then want to attend a protest in one of these different ways. And so we will continue this conversation throughout today's show because it's obviously sparked a nerve with some people. So welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry, and I think we're going to come back later in the show to our conversation around protests, who protests more, the left or the right, and why, because I certainly got a lot of texts on this one. And so, but coming back to our scheduled programming with our next guest, Dr. Matthew Fasciani is a social psychologist, author, and misinformation researcher. His new book is called Misguided, Where Misinformation Starts, How It Spreads, and What to Do About It. And it is out now?
Yes, it is out now. The official date was actually July 8th, but it's already popping up in local bookstores and Amazon. So apparently there's an early release that I didn't even know about.
There you go. All right. Well, before we get started, have you ever been to a protest?
I have. It's been a few years. When I lived in South Carolina, I think I went to one a while ago. Yeah, it's been a few years.
It's been a few years. All right. Yeah. So as far as misinformation, this is a big topic that I feel like comes up a lot. Mm-hmm. Even as we're talking this week, as the more information comes out around Vance Bolter in Minnesota, kind of the wildfire that gets spread when big events happen, whether it's public health, whether it is public safety, and with the power of social media, how misinformation, disinformation, propaganda can spread. So I guess just to go way back to the beginning, what drew you to researching this topic and dedicating your career to researching this topic?
Yeah, so it's been a while. It's been a long journey. I bounced around studying neuroscience and psychology and sociology, and I've always been interested in how people form beliefs and how different factors influence those beliefs. So this even started from my first class I took in psychology, learning about the Solomon-Asch conformity study. I don't know if you've heard of that before. It was a study like in the 50s where...
Not a doctor.
No worries. It was a fun study because they just had these people read these lines on the wall, the different lengths. And it's a very simple task where you try to pick out which line is the same length as the one they pick to. So most of the time people get it right, like 95% of the time. It's very easy. But whenever a few people in front of you purposely give the wrong answer, you're much more likely to conform to what they say and give the wrong answer. So even though this is a very, very basic cognitive task that most of the time people get it right, you could see these early effects of social influence. And I always thought that was fascinating that something as simple as this cognitive task of like identifying how long a line is can be influenced by purely social factors. So I studied that in a few different ways as an undergrad, but actually went into neuroscience for a while And I realized I really wanted to study this phenomenon and do it directly. So I ended up switching away from neuroscience into social psychology to dive into this. And that was like 2015 or so. So it's been an interesting journey this past decade to really study misinformation before it was everywhere in the news and then see it as it is today and try to understand it.
Well, and I guess that's a good follow-up question as far as if you started circa 2015, which feels like a prime decade to be studying misinformation and disinformation, but is this a newer, like, is it getting worse or are we just talking about it more?
I think we're talking about it more. I think misinformation has always been an issue. I mean, really since the printing press, people have been spreading falsehoods. Or even before that, like with oral storytelling. There's always been misinformation. There's always been social biases that influence how we process misinformation. The issue now is at scale. So the social media, AI can just make misinformation flourish. And we are getting more and more in these information bubbles where we're only seeing one side of a story, becoming radicalized, becoming polarized. And that link between polarization and misinformation is really striking, especially here in the United States.
So that's, I was talking about this yesterday a little bit, as far as, less the misinformation part of it, but yesterday I was talking about the Vance Bolter conversation that happened over the weekend as we were getting more information about who he was. And there is now a narrative that's been released into the wild that he, you know, he was an appointee of Tim Walz, which he was, but Tim Walz doesn't actually know him. You know, people putting out there that he targeted these two lawmakers because they had voted against extending health care benefits to undocumented immigrants. So like all these things have kind of been put out into the ether now. Some maybe on purpose, maybe some has just been shared because people thought it was true. But I feel like this is the most timely example we can have of something being put out there. And now how do you even get it back? Like once misinformation or disinformation is out there, why does it spread so quickly and how do you rein it in?
Yeah, it's a big question for sure. So sensationalized emotional content tends to spread more on social media. So that's one thing. And then as far as nuance or fact-checking usually doesn't catch up as well. So it's always a disadvantage. There's an asymmetry between sensationalized content that resonates with someone's identity, specifically their political identity. That's going to be reshared a bunch more than some nuanced fact-check that comes afterwards. So that's the part of like social media.
You're saying fact checks are boring?
Yeah, fact checks are boring. I mean, they are, unfortunately. And they're, you know, 24 hours later sometimes. And by then, it's too late. And it's really frustrating to see even these community notes programs on X and Facebook, where you'll see the misinformation getting, you know, tons of likes. And then you'll see the community note get a fraction of likes. Mm-hmm. And that's just an unfortunate byproduct of that system. So the social media infrastructure doesn't really reward fact-checking and nuance, and it very much rewards sensationalism and appealing to people's identities. And I think that's really the critical part, is like why we have this motivation to begin with to believe falsehoods.
So let's stop there. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll kind of go into the social science psychology of why we do this and why all of us are guilty of doing this. Mm-hmm. And so we'll talk more about that with Dr. Matthew Facciani, who is the author of Misguided, Where Misinformation Starts, How It Spreads, and What to Do About It, after this. We are talking to Dr. Matthew Facciani, who is a social psychologist, author, and misinformation researcher. His new book is called Misguided, Where Misinformation Starts, How It Spreads, and What to Do About It. So, beyond the social media of it all, because I think we can all agree that the share button is maybe the worst thing that was ever created. As a content creator, it's great because where people see your stuff, but it's also, as far as misinformation spreading fast, probably the bane of someone like you, who's like, this is why it's bad.
Well, the share and the infinite scroll. I think
the infinite scroll, yes, that too. But what is it about our brains that is so susceptible to misinformation, especially, and what kind of misinformation?
Yeah, so I think it really helps to think in terms of social identities and how those provide us with a sense of meaning and self-esteem. So we all have like hundreds, maybe thousands of identities, and these help us provide us with like meanings and structure and help us think about the world in a way that makes sense. So it reduces uncertainty. And you can think about the roles associated with a particular identity. So like if you're a parent, you want to take care of your kids. If you're a student, you want to learn things. And when you do those actions, it makes you feel good. And you can connect with other people that share those identities. If you're a sports fan, there's a lot of community around sports. It feels good when your sports team wins. So there's a lot of benefits to this. A lot of structure that, since we're such social creatures, that allows us to connect with other social creatures that share those meanings that we have. And it's all very positive things. The issue is whenever we become so dependent on a narrow set of identities that we are so, we're deriving so much meaning and self-esteem from just a very narrow lens of these identities and values. So whenever we encounter information that conflicts with it, it feels like a personal attack on our entire self. And that's really what my book dives into, is understanding where that bias comes from. Because it's one thing to have this confirmation bias of like, we want to confirm the attitudes that we have. But it's like, where do those attitudes come from? And what can make them stronger on us? So really, the short answer is we need to diversify our set of identities so we're not so dependent on a very small set of them that feels like such an attack when they're challenged.
So, I mean, obviously, when I hear this, the biggest sense of identity is, not biggest, for some of us, right? Mm-hmm. For some people, the identity of your politics, mm-hmm. right? And that is a big one that gets reinforced a lot. But it makes sense as far as being a parent, being a student, being a Wisconsinite, being a Milwaukeean, all of these different things. But how does one diversify their identities?
Yeah. So I think that's the challenge, is getting outside of our bubbles and meeting people who are different than us. Because an extreme example would be if all of your identities completely overlap. So let's say you have a political identity, you have a religious identity, and they don't have any conflict. All the values and meanings completely overlap 100%. And let's say all your friends and where you volunteer is also in that same space. So then any challenging information that challenges that type of value or meaning you have to that identity feels like your entire self-worth is crumbling. So in order to counter that, you need to diversify and have lots of different sets of self-esteem from these various identities. So whenever we think about what that would look like in practice, I mean, sometimes it's very simple, like getting a variety of hobbies and just not being so stuck in politics. Like, politics is such a huge
one. Politics not being a hobby? That's not a healthy thing to have as a hobby? Okay.
It could be one hobby, but it's like, it's just like whenever it's 100%. Again, that's an extreme example, but if it's 100% of how you see yourself, and then whatever your political identity is, you see information that counters that, saying like, the politician I really identify with, you read something bad about them, then that feels really bad to you personally. Whereas if you're more diversified and politics is a smaller part of how you see yourself, you're able to rely on different identities that provide that self-esteem and self-worth. So really trying to branch out, meet different people, people of different political perspectives is definitely a good way to do that as well. But trying to do that, and that's the broader challenge, is like, how do we do that in our country where we're so isolated in our bubbles all the time? And that speaks to like the macro issue with it too.
So let's put a pause there as far as what to do with the macro issue, as we kind of just talked about what you can do personally in your own life. If you have any questions for Dr. Matthew Fasciani, 855-616-1620, shoot over a text. We're going to take one more break. And when we come back, we'll get to your questions and we'll get to the macro question as far as what we can do as a society. Stay with us on Point Taken. We have a couple more minutes with Dr. Matthew Fasciani, who's a social psychologist and author of Misguided, Where Misinformation Starts, How It Spreads, and What to Do About It. So we were just talking about what we personally can do to arm ourselves from being more, be a victim of misinformation. And we were talking about diversifying your identities. Mm-hmm. What can we do at a macro level to rein this in?
Yeah, it's a big question because, again, it requires a lot of moving pieces. So I think diagnosing some of the problems is important. One is the lack of opportunities to meet lots of different people. So we just talked about how important it is to diversify your identities, but if you don't have opportunities to actually meet different people, then that's a challenge. And there's all this work talking about how we're in this loneliness epidemic and people don't have opportunities to meet different people. So that's a big issue. It's like we have this lack of third spaces where people go home, they go to work, but they really can't go to a shared third space and meet lots of different people. And that's a challenge. So ideally, we would be able to fund opportunities for people to meet lots of different people, be integrated in their communities, and have a lot of opportunities for that outside of right now. It's like going to college is a place where you can meet lots of different people. If you live in a city, maybe you'll meet lots of different people, but especially in more rural areas and smaller towns, there might not be shared community spaces where you can actually meet people. So I hope that we invest in that in our future. I think it's really important.
All right. And then final question. I'll keep it more vague, but for people, when you have people in your life who seem to be more susceptible to believing something that's not true that they saw on Facebook or Twitter, or are sharing things, like what is the best way to approach that with the person? One, when they, after they share it, but also just trying to not make their defenses go up, but actually have a conversation with them about it.
Yeah. So there are some strategies that can help reduce those defensive biases. Whenever I think about this, I never go into it thinking I'm going to change their mind. I think it's more about reducing those defensive biases so at least your perspective gets heard and absorbed. And the first baseline is establishing mutual respect. And also, I think it's really helpful to do it in person. Via text or even a phone call can be really challenging. And try and understand, again, how their identities shape their beliefs. So we just talked about how self-esteem is deriving. If people derive so much self-esteem from a narrow set of identities, it can be really challenging to reach them. So try and understand like why this matters to them so much and what's going on in their life, I think, can be helpful. Like, are they going through a tough time and they found this radical group that provides them with structure and meaning and makes them feel better about themselves? And you can kind of try to unpack that a little bit. But those are some big questions. So even before you get there, even just the language you use can be really helpful. So instead of asking like why you believe something, you can try to ask how they came to this conclusion and walk through the mechanism of their beliefs. So like a step-by-step process on how this policy that they support helps Americans, for example, instead of just them, you know, why do you support it? It's like, I support it because it's good. That's kind of like a binary that doesn't help the conversation. So trying to rephrase how we even speak to them and just try to understand like where they're coming from, listen about their perspective and have this mutual understanding that can hopefully reduce polarization on both sides, because then you can also learn about your own biases as well.
Empathy and understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Great. All right. The book is Misguided, Where Misinformation Starts, How It Spreads, and What to Do About It. Available for Amazon bookstores?
Amazon, all bookstores. It's actually going to be at Boswell Books. I'm
great.
Actually giving a...
Love Boswell.
I'm giving a talk there, July 9th.
Perfect. So. All right. Dr. Matthew Facciani, if you want to see him in person, you can see him at Boswell Books on July 9th. And thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. News is next. We'll be back after that.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
Hello, hello. Welcome to the 11 o'clock hour of Point Taken. Have two great guests coming up this hour. Coming up next, we're going to be talking to Carmen Petrie from Sojourner Family Peace Center about why she is advocating for our state legislature to make room in the budget for a new public safety building here in Milwaukee. I know we recently talked to Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley about the same issue. But if you are unfamiliar with Sojourner Family Peace Center, it is the largest nonprofit provider of domestic violence prevention and intervention in Wisconsin. I've interviewed Carmen many times. She is an angel amongst us, and so I'm excited to have her back on the show. And then we're going to be talking to President of Wisconsin Policy Forum to talk about Jason Stein, to talk about the data that they've collected and looking into what dependencies Wisconsin has on federal funding as some of those cuts loom, and what it says about our state funding and whether or not our state lawmakers should be a little bit more concerned than I think they've indicated as far as federal cut funding being cut. So that is coming up at the bottom of the hour. And then we will also get back to our conversation around who protests more, the left or the right, and why? Got a lot of texts about that in our first hour. This was based off of a conversation that was sparked by an email I got yesterday, basically asking that question, asking why does it seem like liberals, to use their term, are in the streets more often than conservatives. And I thought it was a really interesting, genuine conversation to have as far as what it says about political ideology and how we make our voices heard. So we will get to that by the end of the show as well. But I first just wanted to, I mean, this is obviously a very high stakes developing story of what is happening in the Middle East right now. I think we all know that President Trump left the G7 summit yesterday as things were escalating and sent out a Truth Social last night. I think that's how you refer to it, as a truthy, telling people in Tehran to evacuate, which I don't know if you've ever lived in a city that has close to 10 million people in it. The closest I've lived in Los Angeles. I've lived in Brooklyn, not Manhattan proper, but trying to imagine what it looks like when millions of people are trying to get out of a dense urban city and how scary that is, there's some footage I've seen of just miles and miles of car traffic backed up in Tehran last night. But I heard this morning as far as the kind of the crossroads that we're at. By this is from the Playbook podcast from Politico, and this is Jack Blanchard speaking.
What we have now is a president facing an absolutely critical decision, maybe the biggest decision of his presidency. Does he throw military might behind what Israel is doing, and very specifically what Israel wants to do, which is destroy this very deeply buried nuclear enrichment facility that's stuffed inside a mountain inside of Iran that only, we believe, American bombs could get at. And Israel wants America to dive in and do that. And at that point, America is going to war with Iran, and that it would be a very, very big deal indeed. Or is President Trump going to try and use this moment of maximum leverage over Iran to get them back to the negotiating table and sign some sort of agreement that avoids any sort of U.S. military action?
So like I said, I'm trying to watch in between, during commercial breaks, the chyrons on the news stations to see as things are developing. But the stakes are incredibly high, obviously. I mean, just even politically, as far as there's a huge MAGA base that does not want, that said no new wars. And so politically, I don't know where Trump lands on this as far as actually sending U.S. troops to get involved in this. But outside of the online conversation and the political ramifications for this in the United States, just wanting to have a little bit of a touchstone of the reality for people who have loved ones in Israel or in Iran. I woke up to a dear friend of mine who lives here. He's a dentist in Oak Creek. He left Iran 20 or 25 years ago when he was an adult. He didn't leave as a child, but and still has family there. And I wanted to just play what he posted on social media this morning. As a reminder that as we talk about whether or not we should do this and the political ramifications of doing this, that there are civilians who are bearing the brunt of the decisions that these old, yes, they're all three of them are old, whether it's Kamani or Netanyahu or Trump, men who have the nuclear codes, basically. So this is my friend just expressing his concern.
Hey, so I know a few of you have been asking me about Iran and asking hard things there. The short answer is not good. As much as we all like to see all the Ayatollahs gone from Iran, it's still really hard to see the city that you were born in and then you grew up in burned to ashes. The only one thing that Israel does really good is turning cities into ashes, so it's just hard to see that. I still have family there. I have an aunt, I have an uncle, I have cousins, I have friends. They're safe for now, but things are getting worse by the hour, by the minute, and we don't know what's going to happen. In my basement, I have this little skyline of Tehran, and if I go to sleep tonight, I don't know tomorrow that skyline is going to be the same or not, most likely not. And that hurts. And yeah. But I see on Instagram people are posting, oh, let's pray for the people, for innocent people. I don't pray. I don't believe in God. I feel like organized religion is the main cause of human suffering throughout the age. So that's out of the question. But I do have hope, because without it, what else is there? So hoping for better days. what else I can do. I'm too far away from everything, so, yeah.
So on that note, let's hope for better days. Let's hope that this can de-escalate, because a lot of civilians will get hurt in the meantime. All right. When we come back, Carmen Petrie will join us to talk a little bit more about how we can keep people here in our community a little bit safer. This is Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry, and last week, 2 weeks ago, we had Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley on the show, and he, one of the many things we talked with him about was the fact that Milwaukee desperately needs a new safety build, public safety building. It would cost more than $300 million to have maintenance and repairs on it, so there is a big push for a new facility that would cost about $500 million. And the hope is we can get that from the state budget. And so one of the things we often think about when we think of the public safety building is obviously the lawyers who are in there, some of the people who are being charged with crimes being in there. But one thing we might not think is how the public safety building would affect victims of domestic violence. And so I'm very happy to have my friend Carmen Petrie, CEO of Sojourner Family Peace Center, which is the largest nonprofit provider for domestic violence prevention in Wisconsin, here in studio with me.
Hi.
Hi, Carmen.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So make the connection for people of why funding a new building has the downstream effect on the people that you work with.
Well, you know, I want to give credit to the county exec for taking this up. We've known for a long time that the building is in disrepair and needed to be improved for many, many years. It's a complicated and confusing complex. So if you need a restraining order, you're going to the seventh floor of the courthouse to meet with our staff. We've been there since 1985.
Oh, I didn't realize you have staff in this building.
Right, we do on seventh floor. And we've been there since 85. So you go for your initial and then you go for your final hearing 2 weeks later. So you're going into court. So that's on the civil side. You may have a family court issue and you're a survivor of domestic violence. You might have a criminal issue and you're at the complex. And so it's confusing, complex, not friendly, and you're going on one of the worst days of your life, right? We should make that easier for people to access with dignity and respect and efficiency.
How does a new building provide all those things?
Well, I think you could reconfigure it in a way that it was easier to access. Parking should be better. I've heard of people being followed by abusers in the complex. Our staff have been followed. MacArthur Square parking complex is very difficult, dark, scary, some people would say. And, you know, we should have better access. We should have easier access. So instead of having to park, walk a long distance, get on an elevator, go to the seventh floor, maybe we put those pieces on the first floor of the complex that you can get in and out of very quickly and efficiently.
So is the expectation, say the money comes through, is this something that Sojourner would be involved with? Like you were just saying, there's different suggestions of how this could be designed better for victims and people who are accessing the buildings for a variety of different reasons. Like how many stakeholders would end up being part of the design process?
We've already been part of the conversation, and that's a good thing. We've had, what we have not done yet is I'd like to do focus groups with clients to get their opinions, survivors who have used the complex. We also had a client who was murdered years ago in the complex. So safety is really critical, easy access. I'd love to hear from survivors what their thoughts are. We've been part of the conversation with the design team.
That's great. What has the conversation been? Obviously, we know that there was some movement last week with the Joint Finance Committee when it came to education funding and tax cuts. Has there been, have you been part of these conversations with lawmakers?
We have not with lawmakers, but I've done focus groups. I've done an individual, I have a person involved with the design team. I did an individual interview with one of the architects. I support a new complex and would testify or go on record for that, because I think citizens in this community deserve that. I was at the health department when they redesigned neighborhood services. It was third or fourth floor in the health department. They moved it down the first floor and it just was easier to get to. So you had people building things in the city. able to park, get in, get their permits, and get out. I think it's the same concept. But we need safety to be embedded into the easy access. As I said, you know, survivors are visiting this complex sometimes for many days at a time. If you're in a criminal trial, you know, like you're sitting in a homicide trial and your loved one has been murdered, you're there for several weeks getting in and out of this complex. It needs to be more efficient, more effective, safe, have dignity embedded in it. And I don't feel like we have that now. It's an old building designed for a different time. We need to rethink the complex.
All right. Well, our guest is Carmen Petrie, who's the CEO of Sojourner Family Peace Center. Let's take a break really quickly and continue this conversation. And also, there's a 50th anniversary coming up this year for Sojourner. So let's talk about that after this on Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry, and we are talking to Carmen Petrie, CEO of Sojourner Family Peace Center, and why she is advocating for money to be budgeted for a new public safety building in Milwaukee. So to wrap up a couple of the different things, because I got to be totally honest, knock on wood, I have never been arrested. I have never needed to go to court for any being the survivor of anything or the perpetrator of anything. Yep. So I know I am the like majority, I think, people who don't understand what these buildings, how they're supposed to function and why a better design helps the people who do have to access them.
So let's hope it stays that way.
Yes,
the other thing I would say is, you know, if you need a marriage certificate, you got to go in and out
of
this building.
Well, I did have to do that.
Right?
Yeah, and I did have to do that.
You know, things like that. I think there are ways that you're exposed to people who might have hurt you, defendants in cases that may be transported to and from the courtroom. That can cause trauma. We need to rethink respite areas for people who are involved in civil criminal court where there are safety issues. And there are absolutely no family or child-friendly areas in the courthouse. Rethinking the complex would allow us to build a center that's built for modern times. You know, the courthouse is beautiful, but we really need to rethink the whole complex. How do people, what are people coming for? How is their experience when they're with us? How do they get in and out with safety and efficiency? So that's my piece of why I'm supporting it. And survivors for years have had to go, and it's a very traumatic experience going into a confusing complex.
Got it. So, all right. Well, other, I don't know if this is, I don't even know how to frame this, but it is, it is Sojourner's 50th anniversary this year. Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
And it's one of those things where you hope you, this is the kind of organization that if only you could be out of business because the services weren't needed anymore, right? That is the ideal, and yet it is not.
Yes.
So that's why it's kind of weird. Just like, oh, happy anniversary, but you have been doing incredible work for 50 years. And so what are some of the things that are planned for this year?
You know, I think we're very fortunate. You said it exactly right. We want to be here for people who need us, but we don't want to be here because we want violence to be ended in all the ways that it's impacting people. We have our Be the Light event, our anniversary, September 12th, Friday, at the Baird Center. And so we're inviting people to come and celebrate with us. We're going to be uplifting the voices of survivors, doing some 50th anniversary videos of people who were around for the last 50 years and honoring the people who really built the agency as it is today, and then hopefully talking about our vision for the future for the next 50 years uninterrupted is how I say it. Because survivors deserve, whether you're a woman, a man, or a child, if you're being hurt by violence, you deserve to have services that restore you to safety and well-being.
So I know the last time we talked, the uncertainty of federal funding is certainly front of mind. Has there been any more certainty for you, or as far as how you guys are navigating?
You know, we lost funding when VOCA was reduced last year. We lost some money in the budget this year. But I think the environment being so volatile and uncertain is very difficult. There's a lot of challenge around the Office on Violence Against Women and funding that comes down. I think the more uncertainty we live in, the harder it is. This work is already hard, but to do it in an environment of uncertainty makes it even more difficult. But to date, we're holding our own. We have supporters that have stepped up. We're inviting people to donate their time, treasure, or talent to us. It's critically needed. And Sojourner also lives in an ecosystem with other organizations who are already, we're hearing news, are closing their doors one day a week. And that just means less services for survivors.
So if you would like to get more information on the 50th anniversary or Sojourner in total, you can go to familypeacecenter.org. Carmen, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. It's always good to see you.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. So we all know that the conversation is continuing in D.C. around the reconciliation bill going through the Senate and what will end up getting passed. And so the conversation around the reconciliation bill has obviously been around federal funding cuts, obviously also with DOGE, and how much federal government is spending and how that trickles down to the states. And so when we've had Matt Smith on from WISN on Mondays, the interviews he's had so far with Republican Wisconsin lawmakers is when he asks, are you worried about federal cuts? The answer has largely been, no, we're not really thinking about that. We're not really putting that into our calculus for our state biennial budget talks. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? I don't know. But Jason Stein, president of Wisconsin Policy Forum, joins us now because their recent paper, or their most recent paper, called Federal Funding Cuts Loom, looks into how much we as a state rely or don't rely on federal funding. So welcome back to the show, Jason.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I guess, I mean, assuming for all the reasons I just laid out was why this was important to dive into, to kind of look at the numbers as far as what federal funding does Wisconsin get, how much of it, and who does this affect. Is that kind of the motivation behind it?
Exactly. We don't know what is going to happen yet at the federal level, but we can sort of talk about what is the federal government's role in the state, and, you know, what are the areas that could be affected, and what would that mean?
And so if you lay the framework so far as where Wisconsin is with how much money we do get from the federal government, we get less, do we get less than we pay in or more than we pay in?
Well, we get more than we pay in. Almost every state does right now, and that's why we have a federal deficit and debt, and it's something that I think everyone should have concern about. Mm-hmm. And we certainly don't detract from that. At the same time, Wisconsin also receives much less than the typical state. So in 2022, according to figures from the Rockefeller Institute of Government, Wisconsin received about $14,700 in federal payments per state resident. You know, there are states like Virginia, Maryland, Alaska that get approaching double that. And so we're in the bottom 10 states nationally, and that's long been the case for Wisconsin. So, you know, we lag most other states in receiving federal funds, but at the same time, there's still a huge important thing in Wisconsin, nearly a quarter, you know, they add up to almost a quarter of personal income in the state. So, you know, big changes to federal funds in the state could still have significant effects.
So what are the major programs that federal funding goes towards in Wisconsin?
You know, the big three are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Each of those programs has more than a million participants in Wisconsin. You know, they're, to some degree, they're overlapping people. You know, when you think about Social Security, you're talking about on the order of $30 billion a year in payments. You know, Medicare and Medicaid are less, but they're still, you know, from, you know, let's say $7 to $13 billion a year. So, you know, if you're making changes to Social Security, you're talking even a 1% change to that program in Wisconsin would be hundreds of millions of dollars. When you're talking about Medicare and Medicaid, you know, a 1% change could be in the tens of billions of dollars for those programs. So those are some of the big ones. Other ones include defense nationally is not as big in Wisconsin. We just don't have as many big military bases. Other programs include food stamps, higher education, a number of programs there, including research at the University of Wisconsin and other higher ed institutions. grants to K-12 schools and then grants for roads and bridges and transportation. Those are some of the big ones in the state.
So if the funding for any of these programs gets cut, is it something that has ripple effects that everyone feels, or is there certain groups that specifically are going to feel the brunt of this?
You know, it could certainly affect some groups more than others. So when we talk about, you know, the average federal spending in the state, it really varies widely by individual how much that affects them. So, you know, when you talk about the federal government's direct spending on programs like Medicare and Social Security that are for a specific beneficiary, you know, you could have individuals in Wisconsin who, you know, retired individuals who are receiving up to $100,000 plus of benefits in a given year, you know, if they're receiving Social Security and they have significant medical claims. And then you could have individuals that are not receiving any direct payments or direct benefits from the federal government. So it really varies widely the degree to which individuals could be affected.
And so as the conversations move forward, if we were to say the Joint Finance Committee in Wisconsin were to finish our biennial budget before this reconciliation bill is finalized, what happens if there ends up being a gap, like a funding gap? And is there ways to retroactively for the state to decide to go back and fund things where there's now missing funds that the federal government used to invest in?
I mean, the big impact that could be at the state of Wisconsin level for the state budget is Medicaid. That's like an order of magnitude bigger than most of the other federal programs that affect the state. So Medicaid is on the order of a $7 to $8 billion federal funding to the state of Wisconsin each year, more than a million Medicaid recipients who receive coverage through, it's a joint program, both state and federal, and the state funds about 40% of it typically, and the federal government funds about 60%. So that's where you could see your biggest impact. But there could also be impacts in areas like education or higher education. You know, there's a number of federal programs that would affect public universities like the University of Wisconsin, as well as the technical college system in the state. But I would say Medicaid is really the one to watch, both because there's actually been proposals to cut that program, unlike Medicare and Social Security, and because, you know, again, for the state government, there's a significant state taxpayer component of that program.
Got it. We have about a minute left with you, Jason, but obviously Wisconsin Policy Forum is a nonpartisan, neutral research entity. And so you are neutral on the proposed federal changes. But what, right, with the deep dive into these numbers that you guys published, what do you want people to take away from it?
You know, I think we don't detract from the fact that there is a significant federal deficit and debt that needs attention. But at the same time, you know, it's worth people paying a lot of attention to these programs because there is this really foundational federal role in the state. And, you know, whether we're talking about the veterans hospitals, whether we're talking about, you know, federal contracts that go out to, you know, companies like Oshkosh Truck, there's a significant federal presence in Wisconsin, and it does matter what's going to happen at the federal level. You know, last thing is, you know, I think probably the most significant thing to watch so far, as I've mentioned earlier, have been the proposed Medicaid changes. And we've written about that both in this current report that's available for free on our website, as well as we did a big study on Medicaid that we published back in September that your listeners can also check
out. I remember that one. I think I interviewed after that one as well. But the current report is Federal Funding Cuts Loom. He is Jason Stein, president of Wisconsin Policy Forum. Thank you so much for your time today, Jason.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We'll be back with more after this. All right. Well, this show flew by today. We still got a couple segments left before we hand it off to Midday News. But I did want to come back to our earlier conversation around protesting and who protests and why. And I picked out one of the texts that we got that I think is another, as she said, this is a great topic. Another topic, myself and many friends are curious about why do we celebrate Black History Month, Gay Pride Month every year, and we give one day a year to the men and women who serve our country every day and to those who have given their lives while serving their country. Then when President Trump sets up a celebration for the Army's 250th anniversary, the left made it sound like it was all about his birthday instead of celebrating the true reason for the celebration. How about a month-long celebration every year for our servicemen and first responders? Well, just for fact-checking, I know that we said earlier in the show that fact-checking is boring, but May is actually officially recognized as National Military Appreciation Month in the United States. And then November is National Veterans and Military Families Month. Obviously, I think you referred to Memorial Day, but then there's also Veterans Day in November. And so I don't know. So there are, I mean, think about it. What if we look up what today is, everything has, there's Peanut Butter Day. There's like five different cheese days and beer days. Like everything gets some kind of observance. So I definitely think that there is, I know in May there is, first responders have different weeks. The police force has an observance, a week-long observance. I think that's why Steve does his salute to service in May typically. So there are celebrations and month-long celebrations for the military, for veterans, for maybe not a month for police officers or first responders, but they certainly have different days and weeks that are recognized for them. And I don't know. I don't know if it's because they exist, but there's more media attention to Black History Month or Pride Month. I certainly don't think it's because there's more people who are, I don't actually know what the numbers are as far as living veterans and living currently serving military troops, that one would get more attention than the other. But, and I don't know if it's because of the nature of them, where Black History Month is supposed to be a celebration of trying to spread more information around the impact that Black Americans have had that we're not always taught. And same thing with Pride Month. I don't know. I mean, I would agree that there is a difference in media attention for different month-long observances, but it doesn't mean that they don't actually exist. So wanted to put that out there. But like I said, we're running out of time. So we're going to take one more break and then wrap up the show after this. Jazz, I don't know if you're watching the text line, but someone called out your great bump music today. You're a big fan of what you've been playing, so keep up the good work.
I try.
We are doing just fine without Steve. We still have a handful of shows before he is back next Wednesday, but today was really fun. Like I said, this conversation, I think it was a healthy one as far as who protests and why. And I still, there were so many texts, I still haven't gotten a chance to read any of them. But if you have thoughts, feel free to shoot me an email at kbrey@goodkarmabrands.com. Like I said, that whole conversation was spurred from an email. So if you ever have thoughts about the shows or topics we should cover, feel free to be in touch. I know Steve loves getting email. I love getting email. As long as it's nice. I don't love getting the, oh, you're just a libtard, insulting emails. Those aren't great. I have pretty thick skin, but I'd rather not get those, you know? But yes, as always, feel free to slide into DMs or shoot an email with feedback on this show or any show. If you missed any part of today's show, you can always listen to it as a podcast, which you can find at WTMJ.com. Or if you just text POINT to 855-616-1620, we will send you the link. And that on that page, there's the link for Spotify or Apple and all the different places that you can find your podcast, and you can subscribe to it, and then it will just be in your feed and you can listen every day. It's only an hour when it's on the podcast instead of 2 hours on air. A big thanks to our guests today, Carmen Petrie, Jason Stein, and Matthew Facciani. Lots of interesting guests coming tomorrow as well. We're going to have a legal hour, first hour tomorrow. Yes, Jim Santel and Mary Kuhnmensch will be here for my birthday to talk all things that are happening in the U.S. Supreme Court. I know there was some news today that we didn't get to with the Wisconsin Supreme Court regarding lame duck laws. So we will get to all of that with the two of them for the first hour tomorrow. And then we're going to be talking about special education funding with the executive director from Disability Rights Wisconsin. And Thomas Jacobson's going to be here, who's a former Milwaukee attorney who is taking on Netflix over the Dahmer show from a couple years back. And so I'm excited to have that conversation. But as always, we've got to pass it off to Midday News. So thank you for everyone who texted in and called in today. Great show, and we'll see you tomorrow.